these...
Passion for craft with students.
The historic project of William's professional life was to bring new alternative energy technology to the world. And he aimed to do this through the company he founded, SunPower. Like any real-world historically embedded human enterprise, there were ups and downs, compromises and sidetracks, funding challenges and deals made. It was a struggle embedded in its times and yet driven by a vision. Chasing a vision in the midst of real-world entrenched power structures requires working through those risks and seizing the opportunities that arose. Throughout all of this and underlying it all was the process of invention. In what follows, Faith draws out the story of SunPower and the often complicated role played by its visionary inventor.
So when you started SunPower, of course, you called it SunPower, and you based it on the premise of creation of electricity from solar energy.
That's correct.
So how did the American Gas Association contract sort of feed into that original vision?
It didn't. Yeah, it was a completely separate contract, and it was part of American the Gas Association to do research on ways to use natural gas. So it was a perfectly normal step for them. Hire these guys who claim they can take natural gas and turn it into refrigerant. That was it.
So how did that contract proceed? Were there any glitches, or did that end up with the product they wanted?
Well, what happened was we were well-funded, no problem. We worked on it. We made this machine. We demonstrated it to AGA, American Gas Association. And as soon as they saw it, they took it away and gave it to GE because they were serious about making a product. But this is totally outside SunPower. GE had no interest in the technology whatsoever, except that it was attached to government funding. And when the government funding ran out, GE just pulled the plug immediately. And that was the end of that program. Meanwhile, I'd been scraping around to find some of the others. And the compendium has a history of the early days of SunPower, indicating one sponsor after another, each one of which was off target, my target, but on the money.
So what about the whole solar array? That was the Cummins project, right?
That came much later. Cummins project was bizarre. It turned out that one of the Cummins managers, Jerome Davis, was given some money. It was kind of left over out in left field, not very important, and told to do something in the way of a possible new product. Jerome Davis was very open with us. He came down and he said, look, I've only got a limited amount of money. It's going to run out one of these days, but I can fund a solar project for you guys. I said, well, I've had enough experience to know that government-sponsored projects will quit any time at all, and it's extremely difficult to live through a sudden cutoff of 30 guys, which is what the government would do. So I said to Jerome, please inform me if Cummins themselves are investing money and are serious in a project. He said they were. The project went on, went a technical success. We brought it down to Texas, tested it out. It fit all the requirements. And then, out of the blue, Jerome Davis says, we quit. And later on, I guess I'll mention this, their senior engineer told us that they had made a horrendously bad judgment, pulling it out of our hands to a bunch of guys who were just blowhards. And it died. It died right there.
Well, why don't I know that it was in the moment when it was displayed in that array in Texas, it was successful. So
yes.
Talk, I mean, your listeners may not know what it is, and maybe we'll put that image there, but maybe just describe technically.
Well, it was a Fricus and Stirling engine made by SunPower, sited at the focal point of a big solar concentrator. Mm-hmm. The sun bounced off the concentrator, focused on the engine, got it very hot when the engine ran and generated electricity. And it was a prototype, everybody realized that. It was far, far more expensive than a commercial product. It was a classic first step mm-hmm. in the way of a prototype. And of course, that's why I mentioned the Cummins. Are you as a company committed? Because the first prototype is actually the cheapest part of it. The more expensive is to turn that prototype into a commercial product.
So sort of standing in Texas and looking up in the sky and seeing that huge array and the operating Stirling engine on the focal point, was that a moment of thinking, this is what I thought when I created the company? This is what I thought we were coming to?
Well, I have an odd mind in that regard. And it's shared by ever so many R&D engineers. I look at it as a design challenge. I go through in my own head all the steps, and then by the time I'm convinced this is going to work, not by anybody telling me, but that I have raked over the laws of physics and there's nothing to stop it. So I'm convinced. It has nothing to do with money at that stage. And oddly enough, lots of people, including me, are not so much interested in the prototype because we're certain it'll work anyhow. It's not proving anything to us. That prototype proved itself to other people when I had done it years ago, just in my head. It was, quote, obvious, unquote. People don't like for me to say that. It was obvious in my head it was going to work, and I felt like so many other R&D guys, the rest of this job is you business guys' job. I've thought the thing up. I know it's going to work. Go to it. I'm going on to the next problem. So that was kind of my idea. When I saw it up there on the Texas Plains, I said, well, there wasn't any doubt about it. I never had the slightest doubt. This is just a money job. It's like fixing a car. I know exactly what the result is. And this happened over and over again. I had an internal measuring stick, and if the thing that we were thinking of fit my measuring stick, I would say, all the rest is engineering. You guys can do it. I'm not going to have any aha moment because I have a damn good head about how machines work.
There is a famous expression from the movie Field of Dreams. Build it and they will come. In the hard knocks world where commercial power rules the day, it ain't so. Ideas, designs, solutions, they're absolutely necessary, but never enough. In that hard knocks commercial world, it's power that counts. Faith advances the SunPower story by drawing out William on how his visionary technology bumped into the world of decision makers. The power that runs the world is not just the kind created by William's technology.
Yep.
In your own mind, given the successes and failures and the things that you've seen bring themselves close to where you thought they should go, what is that the key role in a bring a new product to market, bring an innovation to market team? What are the elements of that kind of team?
Well, Dan and his bicycle business And my professors in the university all told me the same thing. If you got an idea, you know it'll work, and even if better, if you got a prototype, go to the top man in the company you're thinking of. Do not get happy about the fact their engineers are enthusiastic. That doesn't count. The decision maker, the CEO, has got to be convinced that this widget is something he wants to make. And that step was what I forgot. I tended to be very happy with engineers getting enthusiastic. Engineers in all those companies were enthusiastic. They said, oh, this is great. And then they bring it to the boss. We don't do that kind of thing. I'm not interested. That's the end of it. If you start with a boss, which I almost never did, you get approval of the boss, and the rest of it goes nice and smooth. But I failed over and over to realize I had to talk to the top guy. If I couldn't get him convinced, this project was not going to go.
So there's another, of course, business people are always thinking up the latest way to define how one commercializes and the best way to do business. And one of the latest sort of methodologies of business development is not so much to focus on the innovator, not so much to focus on the boss or the hierarchy of how you get something somewhere, but rather to focus initially, particularly in the creative process, on the prospective client. So the idea is you have what they call a minimally viable product, like say, you know, that engine working on the solar array in Texas, and you bring by 30 people who might potentially be end users. And you ask them what they think. Will this operate within their context? Will this really fit is this the solution to the problems they have? And that you iterate your design on the basis of that. So is that something that rings true for you? Not true? Did you ever do that?
It's absolutely true. As a matter of fact, as you speak, I realize that's even more important than talking to the CEO. If you can convince the customer, and he says to the CEO, I want this machine, you make it, I'll buy it. That is the critical step. That is the absolute critical step. Because if the CEO is talking to an honest guy, a customer, with money in his pocket, he's just acting like a CEO to say, let's do it, let's satisfy this guy. And both of those steps were absent. Both of them mean I didn't convince the CEO. And I didn't dig up the guy who would like it as a market.
So the sort of jargony term we use is customer validation. If you have customer validation of whatever product, whether it's a new app or a brand new Stirling engine.
You're right,
then
absolutely.
That's something that we feel is essential as we go through the development process of getting a business together.
Bringing about change requires confronting decision makers and the power that lies behind them. William picks up on Faith's ideas about customer validation and turns them into tools for driving decisions and influencing the powerful through the grassroots of customer demand for solutions. Faith drives the conversation to an essential question. What if your solution is of value to the end user, to us, the customer, or more broadly, humanity, and yet it does not speak to the interests of the powerful decision maker, which we often think about as tied up with money and profits? William points out that it can be even more complicated. Sometimes the interests of the powerful decision maker can be surprising.
So my question now is to move it further. So your idea about better machines for a better world and bringing electricity to the developing world, for example. The end user are not people who have money in their pocket. The end user, particularly in the era when you began, in the 70s, were individuals who were still under the thumb of colonial powers. So when you marry a better world without funding to visionary high technology, what lessons have you drawn from your 40 years in that business that might inform the youth who are trying to do this in this day?
Well, I think I can easily summarize it. It's really simple. The prototype, the idea, is just the beginning. The real hard work comes from what you just said. Find a potential customer who is enthusiastic. That customer talks to the CEO. The CEO now feels if he works on this thing, he's going to make money, and then he goes. And that was absent. Practically 100% of the time, it was absent.
And if you're talking about things that essentially are, if the customer is funders of the underprivileged, I guess where I'm going is, if we're talking about messaging youth, and we're talking about the political will to assist those who have no money, what kind of vision, what kind of drive, what kind of methodology best fits that situation? You've got amazing technology and it's going to help villagers in Africa, but villagers in Africa themselves do not have the money for this technology in the current stage. How do youth get themselves toward making that happen?
Well, number one, I didn't. Number two, I speak from ignorance when I say what I might have done. What a beautiful example. I went to India. I showed them a biomass fire electric generator. The very wealthy Indian guy, I got a picture of him standing, he's not looking at her. He's looking away. And his beautiful movie star wife is looking the other way. You know, the loincloth operator, the guy, naked guy sticking the wood in it, was very impressed.
I bet.
He told me later, this guy's real smart, he can speak English very well. He said, this is a miracle. But you see, what you say, he can't even afford a hoe.
Right.
Or a pair of sandals. He's got no money. The boss guy said to me, this is the end of the project. I'm saying, this is what he said to me to end the project. Mm-hmm. I came back in. This is Craig Kinzelman and I were there. Mm-hmm. I sat in his lovely palace of a house with very strange interaction of his wife who came in bearing the food. She was a high-class movie actress. I mean, she was like Meryl Streep.
Oh, my.
And she came in barefooted holding these plates and gave them to us. He did it on purpose. He wanted to show off. Mm. He had gobs of servants that could have done that. His wife was a sign. Because we knew, man, this is really some person. And she was a wonderful person. But he said to me, is this done in the United States? And I said, no. And he said, why not? And Craig broke in. He said, well, you have to understand, the United States is very wealthy in energy, and they simply don't think they need it. So the boss man, as a departing gesture, gave us quite a bit of money right out of hand, in our hand, like $10,000 right in hand. He said, I thank you guys for coming, but I am no fool, and I'm not going to buy something that is not used in the United States. That is a barrier we couldn't begin to get over. So he gave us this gob of money as a sort of a gesture that we hadn't totally wasted our time. Mm. But Craig told me, he found out from his Indian friends, this is a classic way of saying goodbye. Mm. Just give him a lot of cash, show him the open door. And that's what he did. That was the end of it. And I didn't even have a chance to say, hey, do you like this thing in an air conditioner? This particular one isn't one, but you sure can. Give me $10,000 and I'll give you a working prototype. I just sort of walked out the door. That was the end. And that was repeated over and over and over and over.
Making things happen in the hard knocks real world is, of course, much more than convincing powerful decision makers of the value of your idea. Ideas, designs, solutions, again, absolutely necessary, but again, not enough. This time, Faith and William explore the nitty-gritty of building a human organization that gets things done, that utilizes resources to make ideas real, that confronts external constraints and deals with unexpected challenges. These are the kinds of things that face a venture when you are trying to create it. An entrepreneur, especially a technology entrepreneur like William, bumps into a contradiction. As the visionary and inventor, in some sense, you are very much alone and on your own. But you can't do anything alone. A human venture, at its given moment in history, is a social enterprise.
So talk a little bit about, you know, once you did get into SunPower, so how, you talked at lunch about, you were just completely ignorant, didn't realize how hard it was going to be, and plunged right in, and that's the only reason that anybody would be an entrepreneur ever. So talk a little bit about how hard it was, particularly at the beginning. What was hard?
Well, all kinds of things I hadn't thought of, like laws, like people need to be paid, like people need to be extremely clearly led so they understand the problem. Any kind of people interaction. Here's a good guy, he's smart, but he's ignorant. I got to spend a lot of time teaching that guy what his job is. After a while, he gets to be very good at it. But initially, he's flailing around. He doesn't know what to do. So a lot of surprises having to do with laws I didn't know existed. And, you know, barriers. Mm-hmm. You shall not use this kind of material or the mass production will use up all that scarce helium in no time at all. You can't design your machine around an extremely rare resource. Things I should have thought about. I knew that helium is one of the rarest elements on Earth. And I knew that the automotive program always ran on hydrogen. Mm-hmm. And I didn't do it. And I thought, well, you know, this is going to get corrected automatically. It never did. Hmm. They still make helium charged engines. Hmm. And this is another point that I encountered that I was flabbergasted at. I was a young engineer, and I thought that there were plenty of people in the world, well-motivated, capable people, who would just be working on the problem, and all I had to do was ask them. What I found was horrifying. Those people didn't know more than I did. My so-called superior elders were ignorant, and some of them were flat-out foolish. So that was a real letdown. I just thought, Wordy, I got lots of good guys out there who will work on this problem and help me because I'm such a juvenile. It wasn't the case. It was not. Over and over again, I would encounter a guy who'd been in the field 20 years and was totally ignorant of the side having to do with global warming. Just ignore it. So one advice I would give to the young folks, check them out. Don't assume they know anything. Really. They might be very good, but more often than not, they're just faking it, which is a very, very great disappointment. Mm. So
what other, so budding young entrepreneurs, what other key advice would you give?
Find as many people as possible that you can team up with. Share your values. The more, the merrier. And even if they just get together every Friday for beer and pizza, which is my guys, that's something that's really valuable. Mm-hmm. Just like we're talking at random, mm-hmm. but get them all together.
I expect a lot more innovations are created over beer and pizza than there are in a formal conference room.
I'm absolutely certain of it. You see, my prophet at MIT used to tell us that. He was, you know, one of the originators of the new physics of the 20th century. Mm. And he said the real productive stuff was taking a walk in the woods and being in a beer tavern and looking at the beer bubbles. Not in an academic situation.
So, key information to entrepreneurs. Walk in the woods, have a beer.
And get together with some buddies to do it.
Right.
So bang the ideas back and forth.
Right.
Keep your mind active and open to possible changes. And above all, keep being modest. Don't think you're right. Think you might be right. Check it out. You'll always find a big surprise.
While the very powerful might see commercialization as monetizing technology, for an engineer, commercialization is making things and getting them used in the world. William's entrepreneurial journey encountered all the opportunities, obstacles, and contradictions of our age. Throughout it all, William moved back and forth from the big idea, grand vision, to the nitty-gritty of an all-too-human world where folks struggle to solve problems. SunPower's slogan, "Better Machines for a Better World," was embodied in a world of entrepreneurship in the quest to change the world through invention and by implementing. Thanks for joining us in this podcast on Visioning the Future. The series is sponsored by the Beal Family, audio by Michael Blankenship. Visit us on the web at visioningthefuture.org, where you can learn more and post comments. Thanks for listening.